This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And on this Monday, Greece voted over the weekend to say no to the austerity measures. It's not unlike the Republican budget. You know, in fact, there are some startling parallels. The Republican budget, you know, slash Medicare, privatize the Social Security, cut Pell Grants so fewer kids can go to college. I mean, it's just, the Republican budget is a massive austerity budget. And this is what Europe imposed on Greece. And it threw Greece into a depression. I mean, they're worse off right now than during the Great Depression. Worse than we ever had it. And they know, you know, how good it can be. They know having a society that works. And what happened here is that the idea of a monetary union, you know, let's let our corporations move across borders freely and all that, and we'll just all use the same currency to make it happen. Well, that's a great idea for big, strong countries like Germany and France. Belgium, Holland, you know, the Netherlands. But for a country like Greece that was just on the edge anyway, it was really a bad idea. They shouldn't have joined the EU in the first place, in my opinion. And in fact, you know, as Matt Taibbi has reported, and I'm just astonished that this is completely missing from any coverage anywhere, Greece never would have been able to join the European Union in the first place because their debt ratio was too high. Had not Goldman Sachs come in, as I recall from Taibbi's article, and had not at least one of the big banksters, I'm pretty sure it was Goldman Sachs, come in and said, you know, okay, we'll buy that debt from you and it'll get off your books, and then we will sell that debt back to you we'll take that debt from you, and now you're in debt to us, but we'll call it something other than debt. And so, you know, it was an accounting trick. And when Greece crashed, I mean, who got paid first? Goldman Sachs. And the money that's going to Greece, I mean, some of the money is going to fund the banks, but much of the money that's going to Greece is being used, you know, out of the European Central Bank. It's being used to pay off old loans and to pay off banksters with new loans. I mean, it's a Ponzi scheme that the European Union is imposing on Greece. Yeah, there are Greeks who don't pay their taxes, and yes, they had a good social welfare system. It's devastated now. And it would, you know, be a good thing, I think, if they tightened up their tax collections. But that's not what's driving this problem. What's driving this problem is that they don't have control over their own currency. It's the thing that conservatives miss when they rant about the U.S. budget deficit, for example. You know, oh, the budget deficit, it's good. Well, the budget deficit is denominated in dollars, and we control dollars. We control the value of dollars. If we want to pay off our debts with cheaper dollars, we can just devalue the value of the dollar. We've done that in our past. In fact, we routinely do it at, you know, 1, 2, 3% a year. It's called inflation. But Greece doesn't have that option because they don't control their currency. So Alexis Tsipras, the prime minister of Greece, said after the vote, I'm paraphrasing from memory here, that people voted on the correct issue. This was not a referendum to pull out, to stop using the euro or pull out of the eurozone. And he said, let's take that off the table. I don't think he's going to be able to. I personally think that Greece is going to have, I mean, here's how it'll probably play out. Assuming that the European Union, which is basically run by Germany, I mean, this whole EU thing is kind of Germany winning World War II. You know, they now control Europe. And for all practical purposes, or much of Europe. And so if they say, no, we're not going to give you any more money, we're not going to loan you any more money so you can pay off your debts to us. As weird as that sounds, if they say that, then and so the Greek banks don't have any money, so the Greek government has no money. They're going to have to, no euros anyway, they're going to have to start issuing IOUs, essentially script, which will become the de facto Greek currency. Now, there is a middle ground. You don't have to just say no to the euro altogether. Look at what the United Kingdom has done. The United Kingdom, England, and countries, they still maintain the pound, the British pound, and you can use euros for transactions in the UK. Everybody takes both. Greece could do that. You know, roll out the drachma tomorrow, devalue it extraordinarily. And Greece, I think, is, you know, of all the countries, maybe you could throw Spain into this category. Well, actually, maybe even Ireland and Portugal, but Greece in particular can come out of this thing more quickly than many, many countries that have a more diversified economic base. Greece is heavily dependent on tourism. And because of the unrest and because of the austerity and you know, all this kind of stuff, tourism has been sagging in Greece. Well, if Greece were to leave the euro and go back to the drachma, they could devalue the drachma, say by half, and suddenly everything in Greece, if you're paying with dollars or euros or pretty much any other currency, you know, relative to the drachma, would become worth twice as much. So if you wanted to go vacation in Greece, your hotel room would cost half as much as the normal price. You could stay at a 5-star hotel for $100 a night. You could take one of those Greek island cruises that are normally $6,000-$7,000 for the week, and you could do it for $3,000, or the $3,000 ones become $1,500. And I think that Greece will see, when they go to their own currency and they devalue it, the internal economy is not so much affected by devaluation, except for imports and exports. And it actually increases their exports, but Greece doesn't export that much. I mean, you know, there's a limit to how much ouzo people want, but although it's really good stuff. But in any case, it helps their exports. It's going to make their imports more expensive. But that's a good thing, too, because what that does is it functions the same way as a tariff. When imports become more expensive, that encourages local manufacturing. So, you know, people will start opening factories and things. They'll say, hey, you know, the stuff from China is now really expensive because we've changed the value of our currency relative to the yuan. And so, you know, let's manufacture this stuff here. We can make it here, you know, cheaper than we can import it from China right now. And I would predict that within a couple of years, at the most, Greece will be back to having a vibrant economy and you know, be a strong country. They just need to reclaim their currency. Now, the other piece of this is that we could find ourselves in the same situation Greece is in if we surrender our economic sovereignty anymore. We're already halfway down that road with NAFTA, GATT, the WTO, and I was going to say permanent normal trade relations with China, but that doesn't have the enforcement mechanism that the WTO and the TPP will have, where we are answerable now, not to ourselves, but to a tribunal made up of corporate lawyers on the world stage. So, anyhow, we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So you want the TPP? You want more of these deals where the United States is not only interlocked with other countries around the world, but unanswerable bureaucrats. In the case of the EU, it's bureaucrats basically appointed by Germany and France. And you know, the larger economies. But with the case of the WTO and the TPP and NAFTA, it's unappointed bureaucrats who are actually corporate lawyers. Right. And if you want corporate lawyers running the show and imposing austerity on us and all that kind of thing, go for it. But I think it's a crazy idea. And, you know, what Republicans are promoting is just, you know, more of the same. Bunch of other things here that I wanted to share with you very quickly. Did you know in Kansas, Sam Brownback, the governor there, Republican, former senator, dropped taxes on rich people in Kansas, just, you know, basically eliminated taxes on billionaires in Kansas, state taxes. The Koch brothers, at least one of them, lives in Kansas. In a new 2015 edition of Who Pays, a distributional analysis of the tax systems in all 50 states, the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy notes that taxes eat up 11% of the income of the poorest 20% of Kansas residents. Meanwhile, the top 1% of Kansas wage earners only pay 3.6% in taxes. Why is that? Because most of the taxes are sales taxes and fees. And so what did Brownback just do? In order to pay for his tax cuts for billionaires that created a billion-dollar hole in the budget, he just raised taxes on working people again. He just raised the sales tax even farther. People pay in Kansas, people now pay sales taxes on food. I mean, this is nuts. Okay. A message from the President of the United States. Seriously, this is actually a message from the president, not from President Obama. I'll let you figure out which president said this. He said, this is a message to Congress. It's an actual letter that was written to Congress by the president about enforcing the antitrust laws. He said, unhappy events abroad have taught us two simple truths about the liberty of a democratic people. The first truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if the people tolerate the growth of private power to the point where it becomes stronger than their democratic state itself. That, in essence, is fascism, ownership of the government by an individual, by a group, or by any other controlling private power. The second truth is that the liberty of a democracy is not safe if its business system does not provide employment and produce and distribute goods in such a way as to sustain an acceptable standard of living. Among us today, a concentration of private power without equal in history is growing. This concentration is seriously impairing the economic effectiveness of private enterprise as a way of providing employment for labor and capital, as a way of assuring a more equitable distribution of income and earnings among the people of the nation as a whole. And he goes on to say, statistics in the Bureau of Internal Revenue reveal the following amazing figures for 1935. I'll give you a little clue as to who wrote this. Of all corporations reporting from every part of the nation, 0.1% of them owned 52% of the assets of all of them. And to clinch the point, of all the corporations reporting, fewer than 5% of them owned 87% of all the assets in all of them. 1/10 of all the corporations reporting. Oh, and then he says, of all the corporations reporting from every part of the country, 1/10 of 1% of them earned 50% of the net income of all of them. The statistical history of modern times proves that in times of depression, concentration of business speeds up. Bigger businesses then has larger opportunities to grow still bigger at the expense of smaller competitors who are weakened by financial adversity. He says 1929 was a banner year for distribution of stock ownership, but in that year, 3/10 of 1% of our population received 78% of the dividends reported by individuals. Is this starting to sound familiar? I mean, this is like Bernie Sanders talking about today. 47% of all American families and single individuals living alone had incomes of less than $1,000 for the year. You add another zero to that for today's dollars. And at the other end of the ladder, a little less than 1.5% of the nation's families received incomes which in dollars and cents reached the same total as the incomes of the 47% at the bottom. This is Franklin Roosevelt's message to the 75th Congress in 1935. 33% of the property, which was passed by inheritance, was found in only 4% of all the reporting estates. We believe in a way of living in which political democracy and free private enterprise for profit should serve and protect each other to ensure a maximum of human liberty, not for a few, but for all. It has long been said that the freest government, if it could exist, would not be long acceptable if the tendency of the laws were to create a rapid accumulation of profit in few hands and to render the great mass of the population dependent and penniless. There is that danger that comes from that concentrated private economic power which is struggling so hard to master our democratic government. It will not come as some of the possessors of that private power would make the people believe, from our democratic government itself. And he goes on, I mean, this just Google FDR's message to the 75th Congress. It just, he goes on and on and on, he, you know, citing all these statistics and saying, you know, it's time to enforce the Sherman Antitrust Act and start breaking up these big corporations. Just, you know, basically comes right out and says, how do we put America back together? As Greece is in the process of putting themselves back together, how do we put America back together? I think we start with our these insane trade policies. And that's why I think both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are doing well, because they're both talking about insane trade policies.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
There's a contrast, though. Donald Trump has the solid lock on the racist vote, whereas Bernie, back in the 60s, got arrested when he was working with CORE in Chicago. So I mentioned we could be going the route of Greece as we continue to surrender our sovereignty to transnational corporations. We're already halfway there. You know, wages have been flat since the Reagan administration, since Reagan declared war on working people in America. Wages have literally been flat since Ronald Reagan came to office. Household income has gone up, but the individual wages have not. The reason household income has gone up is because, you know, now households typically have 2, 3, 4 people working. Dad's working, mom's working, the kids are working, everybody's working to pay the bills that used to be just one single wage earner. Social progress indicator of index for 2015. This is Nick Kristof wrote about this back in April. He says the index ranks the United States 30th in life expectancy. You know, Cuba's ahead of us. 38th in saving children's lives and a humiliating 55th in women surviving childbirth. He says, we know we have a high homicide rate. It's among the highest in the world, certainly the highest among developed nations. And we have a high, and we have higher traffic fatality rates, Nick Kristof writes, than 37 other countries and higher suicide rates than 80. This is from an op-ed he wrote on April 9th, 2015, titled Enjoying the Low Life. We also rank 32nd in preventing early marriage, 38th in the equality of our education system, 49th in high school enrollment rates, and 87th in cell phone use. We're like not even a developed country. And we want more of this? I mean, the top countries, by the way, this is the order. Number one, Norway. Number two, Sweden. Number three, Switzerland. Number four, Iceland. Number five, New Zealand. And number six, Canada. And I'd say, with the exception of Canada, they all those countries would readily identify themselves as democratic socialist countries, social democracies. Costa Rica offered free universal primary education in the 19th century. In the 20th century, they disbanded their military forces and put that money into education. One payoff, Nick Kristof writes, some surveys have found Costa Ricans among the happiest people in the world. And clearly the most well-educated. Scott Walker, by the way, did you see this thing? The Republican legislature in Wisconsin slipped into a proposed budget bill late Thursday. This was last week, just before they went on 4th of July recess. They would shield nearly everything created by state and local government officials from Wisconsin's open record laws, including drafts of legislation and staff communications. You are not allowed to know what your legislators are planning. Now, they're walking it back because there's just been a firestorm. I mean, the you know, one of the local newspapers, I think it was in Milwaukee, wrote a scathing op-ed or editorial about it. But you want to know what a Walker presidency would be like? Try the word imperial. You know, the stuff that they've been accusing Obama of. Oh, man. He's about as far from an imperial president as you can get. But Walker, I mean, when you look at the powers that the president has, I particularly the power to appoint justices to the Supreme Court, who then have the power to basically change our laws or invent laws and make them the law of the land. The idea of a Walker presidency scares the hell out of me, which is, I'm sure, why the Koch brothers are going to back him to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, in all probability. Anyhow, Danny in Bluefield, West Virginia. Hey, Danny, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Just great. How about you?
You've been saying how busy you are. I'm not sure you're hearing all of the other reports that, you know, where information is coming out. So I just want to make sure you're aware of two things.
Right.
One, the TPP, WikiLeaks leaked that in the TPP, once the bill is passed, once it's signed, it cannot be revoked or changed without unanimous consent of all signatory nations. Now, the reason they're doing that is they know you'll never get unanimous consent. Once they've got this great deal, if any one nation says, oh, no, I don't want to revoke it, I don't care if the United States has found out it's a disaster for their economy, we're not going to let you do that.
Right.
Okay, so and they're bound by international contracts.
I wonder, Danny, if there's a similar provision in the Eurozone for use of the euro.
Yes.
And Greece, you know, could successfully just say, okay, well, that's fine, but we're not going to play that game anymore.
I am hoping that what's happening in Greece, it'll basically break up the EU. I'm really praying that will happen.
Yeah.
Basically, the Germans do not consume what they produce. They're known for being low consumers. So is Japan.
Right.
And they've been feeding for 50 years off everyone else's economy.
Right.
And when Greece doesn't have money to buy German cars, the Germans simply loan them the money to buy it and then run up the debt. And then they say now, oh, well, you've got to sell the Greek islands to us to pay off that debt you owe us. It's absolutely amazing.
Yeah,
so
I agree.
So we have to elect Bernie Sanders. And if we don't stop this right now, we're not going to be able to stop it later. Over the weekend, Hillary gave a speech, and she said, as soon as I get in, I'm going to do everything I can to help small business and to cut regulations on business. Now, who does that sound like a Democrat or does it sound like a Republican?
You know, if it was sincere, I know that Bernie Sanders wants to do everything he can to help small business because.
Well, sure.
But the way you do that is by breaking up the big banks and the big monopolies.
What I'm afraid of is Democrats that once they get in, and Clinton did it, Obama is now doing it, and I'm sure Hillary will do it. They need that big corporate money, and they've got to take care of their.
Thanks to the
donors.
Supreme Court. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I'm afraid we have a choice of corporate party A or corporate party B.
If the election
and
comes down,
C.
Yeah, well, we'll see. I don't ever underestimate the power of public pressure. And if Hillary Clinton is elected president, if there is enough of a movement in this country to push for real, genuine change, to basically repeal the Reagan Revolution. And go back to Keynesian economics like we had, you know, the New Deal from 1940 to 1980. It wouldn't surprise me, frankly, if Hillary Clinton could lead that charge as well. Although, as you know, Danny, I know that Bernie would do that. And
we need the liberal side, especially our limited number of people like you. To absolutely take Bernie seriously. I know you do,
yeah.
But the people on MSNBC aren't. Right. And Stephanie Miller isn't. You know, they laugh him off as some kind of a freak that could never get elected. I think he can get elected.
I agree.
If he's the Democratic candidate, Democrats will vote for him.
Yep, yep. And it'll turn out the base. And one of the things that I've learned from, and I think many others have, is that there's no such thing as swing voters. Elections are determined by the base turnout. You know, whoever can turn out their base best is going to win the election. And Bernie is you know, will pull from the base very heavily. I don't know about Donald Trump. I think he's just telling us that, you know, at least 10% of all Republicans are diehard racists. By the way, he tweeted out that Jeb Bush, the only reason Jeb Bush is dissing him, I actually have the tweet here. I should read it from the, hang on just a second. Where did it go? Maybe I don't have the tweet. Yeah. Anyhow, that the only reason Jeb Bush was dissing him. Oh, here it is right here. Jeb Bush has to like the Mexican illegals because of his wife. This is what Donald Trump tweeted out. Yeah. Yeah. Isn't that bizarre? And then he deleted the tweet. But I mean, you know, deleting tweets, really? OK, Danny.
Our worst problem, Tom, last thing, is that the average American is so busy. I don't want to say they're stupid. They're certainly not stupid. But they are ignorant of what's going on. The average American doesn't have time to you know, pay attention to what's going on in Washington and how things are being subverted.
Well, and our media is not telling them the truth, Danny. I mean, the media does not. I have, you know, in all the conversations about Bernie Sanders that I've seen on network television and cable television, I have never once seen anybody or heard anybody talk about Bernie's plans to expand Social Security rather than contract it, to make the government the employer of last resort, any of his issues. They just don't. They won't talk about issues. It's amazing. Danny, thank you for the call. I'm with you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Anything goes summer. I got a whole pile of other news stories I want to get to as we continue through these 3 hours, but we'll be taking your calls too. With you, 10 minutes before the hour. And Linda in Deerfield Beach, Florida. Hey, Linda, thanks for listening to SiriusXM. What's up? Nope, Linda just vanished. I think she probably was reaching to push the take it off mute button or take it off speaker button and push the hang up button. James in Gresham, Wisconsin. Hey, James.
Yeah, Tom, originally I wanted to talk to you about the EU vote in Greece.
Uh-huh.
But I think if we do nominate Bernie, and I'm praying we do, I think he'll win the election with better numbers than Obama.
I think so, too.
I really do.
Yeah.
And I think there will be a lot of crossover voters.
Yeah. I think Bernie represents a real threat to the Republican Party and to the billionaires. And he's come right out and said it. You know, I mean, it's basically like FDR. Yeah. You know, never before have such powers been arrayed against one man. They hate me and I welcome their hatred.
I just think hope he keeps rolling along and picks up steam because it's amazing what he's done in just the last 6 weeks.
Yeah.
The EU, explain to me, Tom, they voted no in Greece. Does that completely sever ties with the EU?
No, all they voted for was to say no to the last proposal that was made to Greece by the Troika, the European Central Bank, the European Union, and the IMF. Thank you, Troy. The International Monetary Fund. And these three are basically who Greece is negotiating with. But, you know, behind the scenes, pulling the strings is Angela Merkel. It's, you know, Germany is really pulling the strings because they are Greece's largest debtor and or creditor, rather. And so that's all they voted on. And Cyprus today, or, you know, last night, came out and said, okay, you know, the vote is not about whether we're leaving the euro, and it's not, or the eurozone, and it's not about whether we're abandoning the euro. It was about going back to the negotiating table saying, no, we're not taking your deal. Our people will not go along with it. Give us another deal. Now, my prediction is that Greece, that the IMF and the European Central Bank and the EU will not be able to give them another deal, because they know that if they give Greece a deal that has stimulus associated with it, that would actually recover the Greek economy. First of all, they're going to exceed their own 3% debt limit that, you know, no country can have, in the EU can have more than a 3% budget deficit. So first of all, they would do that,
right,
because they'd have to fund it the way that Eisenhower did with the highway system, with debt, you know, and then it produces economic growth as a consequence of that. It would be a complete repudiation of this religion of austerity, which has infected the Republican Party here and has spread tragically across Europe. Paul Krugman's been doing a great job of voting on this. And perhaps most importantly, in the minds of the technocrats in Europe, they believe that this would then cause Podemos to win in Spain, and you'd see the rise of similar parties, and it's already starting to happen, but the rise to power of similar parties in Ireland, Italy, and Portugal, the other countries that are in trouble with the EU, that never should have become members of the EU. So, anyhow, we'll see how this plays out.
At the beginning of your show, you mentioned they could go back to the original currency in Greece.
The drachma.
Drachma?
Yeah, all they have to
do that?
They can do that. And I mean, they can't legally do that because of their agreement with the EU, but they can do it. I mean, they're a sovereign nation. They can do anything they damn well please. And
well, if they devalued it by half, I would go to Greece and visit there.
Yeah, I'm telling you, they would have a tourism boom like there was no tomorrow. You know, and in a year or two they would be back where they were before they joined the EU. And it would undo the damage of the banksters. James, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. Thanks for listening to SiriusXM. Linda, you want to try it again?
Yes, I'm so sorry. I apologize. I dropped.
That's okay. Deerfield Beach, Florida. What's up?
I just wanted to thank you, a belated thank you, 4th of July, to you and your family. And
thank you.
My question is, thank you. Your previous callers, a couple of callers ago, I think he was really right. He says the American people aren't paying attention to Greece. And I was in a bank this morning, and, you know, it was busy, and they only had one teller. And he said, you know, he goes, this is ridiculous. And I said, you're able to get your money out of a bank. Thank God you can. I said, do you know what's going on in Greece? And he looked at me. He just looked at me and went, what are you talking about? I said, their banks are froze. Right now they're frozen. I said, they can barely get out 50 euros if they're lucky.
Yeah.
I said, can you in any way, Tom, kind of explain this to dumb it down a little bit? And my second question is, how is this going to affect us here in the United States?
A Greek full-blown default, withdrawing from the EU and going back to the drachma, if they did all of that, and I think it's going to be, I'm guessing it'll be gradual if they do that. You know, it'll be over the course of 6 months or a year, but it could happen quite suddenly. I mean, if the Germans provoke an absolute crisis by refusing to give them any more money, they're going to have to start issuing IOUs, which functionally will become the drachma. So, you know, they may well be on the path of creating their own currency and or creating a parallel currency like England has. The way that could affect us here in the United States is principally through the value of the stock market. If this causes a ripple effect across Europe that makes it look like Spain and Italy and Portugal and Ireland are next, and the Eurozone, at least the periphery of the Eurozone, is starting to fall apart, then that's probably going to hit the European stock markets really hard. And that contagion could spread to the U.S. stock market. We have a big stock market fall. You know, since Reagan flipped us out of pensions and essentially invented IRAs and then ultimately 401ks, a lot of people have their savings, their retirement savings, in the stock market, and they're going to get hurt really badly. But I think that would be the limit of the damage, because we control our currency. So that's and we'll see. I mean, it may be that the Eurozone will say, hey, without Greece, we'll even be stronger, and the European stock markets will go up, although today they went down in response to that no vote. So, Linda, this is a real we'll see scenario as the wise Zen master Mike Dirks used to say. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Neil McCabe on the line with us, political director with Gravis Insights, a Florida-based pollster and columnist for townhall.com, gravisinsights.com, the website. Neil, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Tom. Happy 4th of July.
Happy 4th to you, too, and to you and yours. Okay, I got this tweet from Donald Trump that says...
Of course you did.
That says, hashtag Jeb Bush has to like the Mexican illegals because of his wife. What's going on in the Republican Party?
Well, I think we're sort of in the shakedown cruise phase. You know, I remember when I was in the Coast Guard, every time before we went on one of our drug patrols, we would have what we called a fast cruise, where we would just sort of go out for one day and just sort of make sure everybody was in the right place, everybody could find their lifeboat, and just do a walkthrough before we actually, you know, got underway for the real patrols. And I think we're sort of in that fast cruise or walkthrough phase right now. What are there, 20 candidates for the Republican nomination?
No, I think you're at 14 right now, if my memory serves.
Oh, announced, but yeah. You know, there's some still in the wings. In fact, I don't think Scott Walker officially announced yet.
No, he's doing that this week or next, I think.
Right, and so you have a guy who's consistently number 2, 3, and 1 in the polls, and he hasn't even made his announcement
but,
yet.
But so, my point is that Donald Trump is actively reaching out to racists in the Republican base.
I don't know. I think that
he absolutely is. I mean, you know, come on. And Ted Cruz comes along and says, "I salute Donald Trump." And
I think what's happening, Tom, is that Donald Trump is in touch with what's going on the border states with Mexico in a way that sort of the Northeast elite is not.
But it's not what's going on. I mean, other than these kids fleeing violence that is the consequence of Reagan policies back in the 80s down in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, other than that, with regard to Mexicans, the you know, immigration into the United States for the last couple of years, at least since 2008, since the Bush recession, has been going backwards. I mean, we're not gaining people.
You're saying
we're losing
them. Escaping the United States into Mexico.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Look
so
at
I
the
think,
statistics.
I think that maybe if Trump is guilty of something, he's generalizing and calling all Latin American immigration Mexicans. And I think that's maybe a poor term of art. But certainly now, what's going on down there is tragic and scary.
Yeah.
People are legitimately scared for their families. It's like, talk to those ranchers about the coyotes herding those illegals through their ranches at night. You know, look at the crime wave that's been unleashed by these illegals. And Donald Trump is speaking to real problems. It's resonating.
It's,
you know?
You know, the two towns that have the lowest crime rate in the United States are San Diego and El Paso. There's
okay.
Basically on the Mexican border, and there is it's not a crime wave. I mean, there is a crime wave going on in northern Mexico. You know, I don't disagree that this is a problem.
Let me make this point about El Paso specifically, because I know something about El Paso, because I know a number of people who are stationed at Fort Bliss, which is right outside of El Paso. The fact of the matter is that the drug lords and their lieutenants all live in El Paso on the American side. And so, yeah, El Paso might be safe in the way that, say, a mafia neighborhood is safe, and that a grandmother can walk through the streets of a mafia neighborhood at 2 a.m. and not worry about anything. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a crime problem.
Yeah. We're not going to solve the immigration crisis in this conversation, I don't think, Neil. The other thing, though, that Donald Trump is talking about that I find fascinating is that he's saying all of our trade deals were stupid. He's taking a Ross Perot kind of position.
Very much so.
And A, I think that that will get him a lot of votes right across the board. On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders is saying the same thing. And B, I think that in particular is going to make him harder to dislodge, because as far as I can tell, none of the other Republican candidates wants to do anything about these pro-corporate, corporate dominance of the U.S. kind of so-called free trade deals.
Well, first of all, let me just say two things about Donald Trump. Number one, he's sort of our version of Boris Johnson. He plays the buffoon, and for a lot of people, it's disconcerting and flummoxing.
Who's Boris Johnson?
Boris Johnson is the mayor of London, who basically is regarded as
Boris.
Idiot in London. But he,
yeah. Yeah, Boris. Right. Yeah, I got it.
Yeah. He's regarded as an idiot, but he may end up being prime minister of England in 5 years, you know? Yeah. And so Trump is playing on a different, or is broadcasting on a different frequency, which is why the elites don't get it. But as for the trade deals, yeah, I mean, Trump is calling out a lot of things that he's just calling it stupid. I mean, it's Ross Perot was plugging into what I call the Caesar impulse, like the idea that a strong man can come in and just fix things. And that's exactly what Ross Perot, if Ross Perot was elected president and he announced that he was suspending Congress, the American people would have said, okay, Ross, just fix it. I mean, that's the Caesar impulse. And Trump is playing into that, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that I don't think it's that simple. I think that he's, because presidents do negotiate these treaties.
Well,
you know, and presidents can unnegotiate treaties.
It's an interesting thing, because so much has been done in the last 6 years in the age of Obama by executive action.
Nothing compared to Reagan. I mean, when Reagan came into office, my understanding, and I may have the details wrong on this, but that Heritage, or one of the groups here in town, prepared a giant binder with 3,000, a punch list of 3,000 things they wanted to get done. And by the end of 8 years, Reagan had accomplished 2,000 of them.
Well, I think that sort of plays to my point. So let's just say that a lot has been done by executive action because Obama and the Congress have not been able to work together. And so what happens is if everything's done by the stroke of the president's pen, it can be undone by the stroke of the president's pen. And so this is the situation that the next president can basically undo everything without Congress being involved. And I think that's kind of scary. If you look at the growth of the executive branch, not only do they sort of have taken over legislative or lawmaking functions, but they also have their own administrative court system with judges. And so you've basically recreated our three branches of government inside the executive branch to the exclusion of the two others. And whoever's president is going to have extraordinary powers.
And on top of that, we now see, Scott Walker and the Republicans in Wisconsin want to do away with public records, with the ability of the public to see the legislative process as it goes on. And, it's like, yeah, I'm a President Walker would be a truly scary thing.
Well, I mean, Walker has a lot going for him.
Yeah, he's got the Koch brothers with $800 million.
Well, I mean, Scott Walker has done remarkable things in Wisconsin. And the fact that
he's devastated the state.
He has won elections.
They're like 48th in job creation in the country.
Well, Tom, you and I are old enough to remember when Wisconsin was considered a liberal hold. How is it that a Scott Walker was not only elected, reelected, and survived a recall?
It was without a state money. It's real simple, Neil.
I mean, they even ran a moderate, relatively conservative Democrat against him.
And that's the mistake of the Democratic Party is ever running a conservative Democrat. They should have been, particularly in Wisconsin, they should have run, a Bernie Sanders-style liberal.
But
fact of the matter is that you had millions, probably tens, certainly tens of millions, possibly hundreds of millions of dollars of money, mostly coming from the Koch brothers.
A lot of outside money going against Walker.
I don't see it. Anyhow, Neil McCabe, GravisInsights.com. Thanks, Neil.
Good
talking with you. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back with your calls on Anything Goes Summer here.
Just a minute.
And welcome back. Oh, I got an amazing story for you. I'll tell you in 5 minutes. Let's pick up some phone calls right now. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up? Corky?
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air, Corky.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. I was busy. I wanted to congratulate the women's soccer team first.
Yeah, amen.
And I would like...
Amen. And bad on the people who are tweeting Pearl Harbor, Hiroshima, Nagasaki jokes, you know, with regard to that. I mean, it's brought out the best in a lot of Americans, and it's brought out the worst, unfortunately.
Well, we got 300 million people in this country. You know, the percentage is low. They have no class.
Yeah. As Eisenhower said, their numbers are small and they are stupid. He was referring to the oil billionaires in Texas.
What I wanted to say was, off the top of your head, can you give me the people that voted for NAFTA, CAFTA, and the TWO? And of those people, how many of them lost their seats in Congress?
I don't know the names of any, Corky, because at that time in 93 or 96, you know, I was not doing political talk radio. I was keeping track of what was going on in the world, but I just don't remember. What I do know, and I know this because I read it in an article, I think of an Alternet or Truthout or something a couple of weeks ago, was that there, you know, President Clinton was pushing NAFTA and the WTO, the GATT is what they called it at the time, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades. And he was pushing this really hard, and the Republicans were pushing it really hard. And only 30 Democrats in the House of Representatives voted for it, which is about what we had, you know, voting for fast track. I think there was 28, wasn't it? Of those 30 Democrats who voted for it, in the next election cycle, 16 of them lost their seats.
Yeah, and that was enough to flip the Congress.
Yep, more than half of them.
Yes, well, I would remind these politicians that are thinking about voting for this, of this fact. You're probably going to lose your seat if you vote yes.
Yep.
Because they're not on the same page as the American working public. That's what they have to worry about. They keep talking about all the other constituents. What they got to worry about is the American working public and those who are susceptible to losing their jobs. And what are you going to train them for? They got this provision in there that says, we'll pay for retraining. Retraining what? You're shipping everything out.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are you going to retrain them for?
Well,
The gardeners?
It's an $800 million gift to the private education industry. That's all it is. I mean, and this has been associated. There have been these retraining provisions associated with every one of these free trade deals, because every one of them, we went into them knowing they would cause us to lose jobs, which on its surface seems insane, right? We went into them knowing they would cause us to lose jobs, so we appropriated money to pay for job retraining. That money typically goes to for-profit colleges and trade schools, and by and large, those people graduate and they still can't find a job because the jobs are gone.
Yes. I went to my son's graduation last weekend, and they had to stand up who was going to go into the private sector.
Uh-huh.
And there was a lot of them. What are they going to go into?
Yeah, yeah. Good luck. You know, it's good luck on that. Corky, thanks for the call. And thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Okay, I just saw this on Democratic Underground, and it blew my mind. I got to share this with you, and then I'm going to get back to your calls right away here. These are the words of Senator Bernie Sanders. The surprise is going to come in a minute. He was on the floor of the United States House, gave this speech. You can watch it over at C-SPAN. And he said, we should make no mistake about it. Today is a tragic day for humanity, for the people of Iraq, for the people of the United States, and for the United Nations as an institution. It is also a tragic day for the future of our planet and for the children, 30,000 of whom in the third world will starve to death today as we spend billions to wage this war, and 25% of whom in our own country live in poverty, in our country, because we apparently lack the funds to provide them with a minimal standard of living. Despite the fact that we are now aligned with such Middle Eastern dictatorships as such as Syria, a terrorist dictatorship, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, feudalistic dictatorships, and Egypt, a one-party state that receives $7 billion in debt forgiveness to wage this war with us, I believe that in the long run, the action unleashed last night will go strongly against our interests in the Middle East. Clearly, the United States and allies will win this war, but the death and destruction caused will, in my opinion, not be forgotten by the poor people of the Third World and the people of the Middle East in particular. I fear that one day we will regret that decision, and that we are in fact laying the groundwork for more and more wars for years to come. That was Bernie Sanders in 1991 speaking against George H.W. Bush invading Kuwait to drive the Iraqis out. It was the first Gulf War. Bernie was absolutely prescient. If we had not fought the first Gulf War, there would have been no 9/11. There would be no Al-Qaeda. There would be, there's a whole series of dominoes that come out of the first Bush presidency that then got amplified by the second Bush presidency. But Senator Sanders voted against the first Gulf War in 1991 when everybody was going, oh, yeah, we got to have this. And, of course, Bush was, wanted to have his little war because he thought he would get him reelected as president in the election of 1992. Didn't work out that way. Bill Clinton won, but he thought he could do it. So now, knowing that this is Bernie speaking on the floor of the House in 1991, I believe that in the long run, the actions unleashed last night, this was when the invasion happened, will go strongly against our interests in the Middle East. Clearly, the United States and allies will win this war, but the death and destruction caused will, in my opinion, not be forgotten by the poor people of the Third World and the people of the Middle East in particular. I fear that one day we will regret that decision and that we are, in fact, laying the groundwork for more and more wars for years to come. That's leadership. That's amazing. Mike in Fort Collins, Colorado. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hang on a minute, Tom.
Sure.
There you go. Anyway, I'm a native Kansan, and I was back in Kansas while this vote was going on in the legislature. And
this vote, you're talking about
kind of an informal survey.
Are you talking about the vote to raise taxes on poor people and cut taxes on rich people?
Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, the reactions went from, well, it's the liberal media, to, well, we're going to have to put up with it, to, they did what?
Yeah.
Because people, they're not listening. They're not paying attention to what.
So, in other words, when you told Kansans what was going on, they didn't know what you were talking about?
A lot of them didn't.
Wow.
A lot of them didn't know what was going on, or they didn't believe it. This one guy, well, it's a liberal media, and I said, well, NBC is owned by Comcast, and that's not what I consider a liberal.
No, the company that owns Comcast is very conservative. The family that owns Comcast
right.
is very conservative.
Right, exactly. And I'm sitting here looking. I brought back the Kansas City Star with me. This is the June 13th edition. Of course, they raised the taxes by from 6.5 to – I'm sorry, from – 6.15 to 6.5, that's like 35 cents per thousand.
Right.
A $50,000 automobile would cost you an additional $175 a month. In taxes, not per month. Eliminate most itemized deductions, reduce taxpayers' deductions for mortgage interest and property taxes, increase the cigarette tax, provide amnesty for people who didn't pay their taxes,
yeah.
Postpone schedule decrease in income tax rates on wage earners.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and
yeah. it's crazy.
You should see the pictures there. These guys are weeping. Please, you know, pass these taxes so we can save our state.
Right.
Reminded me of Jimmy Falwell when he got caught with that prostitute.
Yeah.
Not Jimmy Falwell, Jimmy Swagger.
Yeah, Jimmy Swagger. Yeah.
He got caught with that prostitute.
Yeah.
Several years ago, but I mean,
I'm wondering. I lived in Oregon for 5 years, and Oregon has basically one statewide newspaper, and it's owned by a conservative family in New York, or conservative company in New York. And I got so frustrated, so angry with the conservative bias of the Oregonian that I simply stopped subscribing to it, and told them that was why. And they were like, yeah, bye bye. But basically, there's one newspaper in the whole state. Is that the same situation in Kansas?
Well, the Kansas City Star is, you know, that's Kansas City. They're probably bigger than, it's like the Wichita Eagle, and I can't remember what the Topeka paper is.
Uh-huh. So there are still multiple newspapers in the state.
Yeah, there's multiple newspapers in the state. I think I saw, just as an example, if this thing hasn't passed, I think the biggest school district in the state is Wichita. They were going to lose $60 million. The school district I went to was going to lose $10
million. Right. Oh, yeah. They got to cut back on the schools.
They got to
cut back. Right. They got to cut back on the schools in order to pay for the tax cuts for the billionaires. Mike, thanks for the call. Thanks for a Kansas perspective. I appreciate it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with your calls and more right after this. Said today, put out a message. He said, I applaud the people of Greece for saying no to more austerity for the poor, the children, the sick, and the elderly. In a world of massive wealth and income inequality, Europe must support Greece's efforts to build an economy which creates more jobs and income, not more unemployment and suffering. End of quote. Yeah. Well said. Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom, a lot of topics to talk to, but I'll stick with the Greece thing right now. It's very interesting that they talk about pain and suffering because right after World War II, when the Germany was split up into East Germany and West Germany, right, with
right.
the Cold War, Konrad Adenauer was the chancellor then. And with the full backing of the Allies, he actually discounted the war reparations that Germany legally had to pay.
Right.
Greece.
Yeah.
Over a quarter of a million Greeks died from starvation, and there was enormous infrastructure damage, which totals about the money that Germany is owed from Greece today.
Germany did not repay their World War II debts. They did not repay their World War I debts, which was the Treaty of Versailles thing. And,
right.
You know, it's like in the 20th century, Germany is the one country that has not repaid their debts. And yet they are saying that it is the high moral position to repay your debts, Greece.
Right. So why isn't anyone talking about that when on the
every Greek knows this? I'm telling you, Mark,
every Greek knows
this.
Yeah. But, you know, Greece is a very rural country still. You know,
yeah.
if the United States had paid attention and included Greece in the Marshall Plan.
Right.
Which I don't think they did, right? Because they totally rebuilt all the economies of Germany and Japan.
Right.
You know? And it's just not being talked about. And not even at this late date, you know?
Yeah.
It's really, you know, why does Germany always get a pass? Now, granted, after World War One, they were in extreme hardship, right? Because it threw them into a terrible inflationary spiral there in Germany, right? Where a loaf of bread cost like 100,000 marks or something.
Yeah, that was the way that they were what they were doing was, you know, the debt to the other European countries was denominated in Deutschmarks, and you know, like you owe us a billion Deutschmarks, and so they just said, okay, cool, we'll devalue the Deutschmark to the point where, you know, a loaf of bread is a billion Deutschmarks. Here, have a loaf of bread. and
right, but that sort of
it didn't work out all that well.
The rise of the Nazi Party, right?
I mean, yeah, it didn't work out that well because it threw the country into a depression and a hyperinflationary depression. So
explain to me why, because at the time the Nazi regime was a legally elected government, correct?
That's correct.
They overthrew with the fire at the Reichstag and all that stuff, right?
Yeah.
So if they were a legally binding government, why do they get a pass on all this enormous, you know, destruction?
Yeah, because the countries of the world gave them a pass. And, you know, Germany should be giving Greece a pass right now in the same spirit.
Exactly.
And
you know, they should just call it even, you know.
Yeah.
And
well, the Greeks have even said, you know, I think it was the finance minister who resigned yesterday because he's such a combative negotiator that he's managed to anger all of the Europeans that he's been interacting with. And so they said, OK, well, we'll replace him with somebody who's a little more kinder and gentler. But basically, at one point, a couple of weeks ago, he came right out and said, Germany, why don't you repay us the debt from World War II that you have never paid? And with that, we will repay you the money that we owe you. And, you know, and let's inflation adjust it, by the way.
Well,
it did not go over well.
No, because legally Greece signed away their rights when they agreed to that actual, you know, discounted amount.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, and it was purely because to protect the Germans against the Russians, right?
Yeah.
Against the terror of the Red Menace.
Yeah, there you go. No, it was
really,
it was
totally fascinating.
They were leveraging their position in the middle of the Cold War, and Mark, thanks for the call. It's fascinating stuff. It's fascinating stuff. Dave in Canton, Michigan. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind?
Yes. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a couple of small pet peeves, and I'd like to talk about Greece if I have the time. First thing is,
we'd prefer you pick one topic and go for it.
Okay, well, then I guess I'd rather talk about Greece then.
Okay, go for
it. That seems to be the topic of the day. I don't know if you noticed on the TV about how the shelves were all empty in Greece. There's a reason for that. They don't produce anything, just like they're trying to turn our country into a country of non-producers.
Right.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, that was my earlier rant was, you know, if we keep going down this TPP road, we're going to end up like Greece because, you know, we won't lose control over the dollar technically, but if we started adjusting the value of the dollar in order to get trade advantage, we'd be sued by the TPP or by the WTO. I mean, it's like and the Greeks, of course, don't have economic sovereignty. They don't own their own currency. And I think they need to get there pretty quick. I mean, they need to get the drachma back into circulation. And, you know, we'll see how that happens and when that happens and all that kind of stuff. But, yeah.
Well, any country, we cannot import our way to prosperity. And that's the problem with the Greeks. The Greeks don't
Correct.
Produce anything, but the producers are willing, northern countries are willing to loan them money because they're producers. That's why they have money to loan.
Right. Germany is a net exporter. They run trade surpluses and have for years and years. And, of course, those trade surpluses represent debt to the countries that are running trade deficits, just like we've been running a trade deficit ever since the Reagan era. You know, so we're now one-seventh of America is now owned by non-Americans, corporations and individuals. And, you know, because we've been running these huge trade deficits. And yeah, I don't know the trade situation with Greece, but I really truly think if they got the drachma back, it would be such a boom, and they devalued it relative to the euro. It would be such a boon to their tourism industry, and the whole world is would see that this ideology of kind of basically one world governance or one continent governance, you know, in a multicultural, multi-language society, it just doesn't work. I mean, you see, these countries are countries for a reason, and this experiment, this EU experiment, I think is doomed to fail. And I sometimes wonder about the American experiment. If you look at the American South, and it's like, you know, the states that have not expanded Medicaid, with one exception, every single one of them was in the Confederacy. It's, you know, the states of the Confederacy are, you know, you're more likely to be poor, you're less likely to have health care, you're more likely to be a victim of crime, they have the highest crime rates, and they're net importers of U.S. dollars, whereas states in the North and California are net exporters of U.S. dollars to those other states. So it's You know, I don't think that we're going to break up, but sometimes I wonder. Dave, thank you for the call. Thought-provoking. Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay. If Greece does decide to go back to the drachma, they would have to print and manufacture all that currency and coins.
Correct.
So first, if Greece does that and is broke already, if you had to guess, how much money would that cost Greece to manufacture? And second, how much does the U.S. spend on producing our currency and coins?
Well, the first thing you need to know, Michael, is that the vast majority of U.S. dollars do not exist as paper. I mean, I don't know what the total currency in circulation is around the world in U.S. dollars, but it's in the trillions. And the vast majority of it is numbers on computer screens. Banks don't deal in paper, basically. So first of all, if Greece wants to go to the drachma and print drachmas, they can, you know, the government can grant drachmas or loan drachmas presumably Greece would create its own central bank. The central bank could loan drachmas to the Greek banks, and this is just numbers on a computer, and then the Greek banks have them as numbers on a computer, and occasionally people are going to come in and say, I want 300 drachmas, please. But mostly they're going to say, okay, I've got a credit card with this bank, and I got some money in my account, some drachmas in my account, and I'm going to use my credit card at the local store. So the store is taking an electronic drachma, and then the store, you know, puts that in their bank, and it's just, it moves around, but it's all moving around as you know, zeros and ones, as binary data, as digital data. So number one.
Exactly.
Number two, in terms of, you know, the practicality of it, there are companies, I believe, that print currencies. And there's a bunch of currencies still in use in Europe. All the Scandinavian countries have their own separate currencies. The British have their own separate currency. And I'm pretty sure that I read an article a year or two ago about a company that was providing currencies that was actually even trying to get some U.S. contracts. We make our own currency here in the United States. And I don't know if all of those countries make their own currency or if there is like some third party that they could go to. But even if there wasn't a third party they could go to, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, if Greece went to Sweden and said, you know, you guys are printing your own currency, would you mind printing ours? I don't think it would be an enormous price. I don't think that that's the challenge that they're facing. The challenge they're facing is how do you take an economy based on euros and convert those euros? How do you deal with somebody who's got a mortgage on their house of 100,000 euros? How many drachmas does that become? How do you pay that off? And I think the transitional phase is to become like the United Kingdom, where you can either do deals in euros or you can do deals in drachmas. And the government is only doing deals in drachmas because that's all they've got. But in the private marketplace, people can continue to do deals in euros. And then over time, the drachma basically overcomes the euro, or at least it's a strong, you know, a bulwark against the euro, as is the case in the UK. So, Michael, thanks for the call. 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Anything Goes Summer. Back with your calls on whatever topic you would like. I think the Talk Radio News Service is going to drop by in a few minutes, too. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything Goes Summer. And Howard in New York. Hey, Howard, what's up? Oh, we have Talk Radio News. Is that who's on line 11? Oh, okay. There was no name there. Is that Victoria? Oh, Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service at the White House, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world today?
As South Carolina lawmakers have begun debating today whether to move the Confederate flag that's flying outside government buildings to the state's military museum, a joint state and federal investigation into the activities of accused Charleston church shooter Dylann Roof has widened to include other persons of interest, according to multiple sources familiar with the ongoing investigation.
Are they looking for people that might have radicalized him, or are they looking for the people that he told what he was going to do? Several of them have spoken about this and didn't take him seriously.
They're looking at people who had some knowledge of what he planned to carry out, the sources are saying.
Right.
They're looking, they've begun exploring how much Roof's associates knew, when they knew it, after reviewing his cell phone and computer records. They're still studying exactly what charges, if any, some of these associates might face.
Right.
They're looking at possible misprision of a felony, which means a person had knowledge of a crime to be carried out, didn't tell law enforcement, could be also lying to a federal law enforcement officer.
Wow.
So this is what they're looking at the moment.
Okay.
Also in Greece today, those in Greece who are nursing hangovers from celebrations yesterday after their no vote on their referendum,
mm-hmm.
which was to reject the bailout, but many people also feel that it was to reject staying in the Eurozone. Prime Minister of Cyprus spoke with German Chancellor Angela Merkel today and is supposedly going to present new proposals to Eurozone finance ministers tomorrow at an emergency meeting that they are holding.
This is going to be interesting.
It's going to be very interesting.
Yeah. He came out and said that this was not about our leaving the Eurozone. Do you think that the Cyprus government is totally committed to maintaining the euro, or do you think that in the background they're negotiating to bring the drachma back?
It's very hard to tell. He also spoke today with President Vladimir Putin.
Right.
And they discussed the vote, and they discussed the future, to some extent, apparently.
If Greece gets a large line of credit from the Russians in exchange for bringing back the drachma and leaving the EU, that's going to create a very interesting alignment. There was a time, wasn't there, in my lifetime? I think it might have been in the 50s or 60s when the Greek government was kind of a military government, and they were.
There was a military junta, yes.
Yeah, and they weren't aligned with Russia, or with the Soviet Union, but they were sort of like Egypt. They were, Nasser, trying to play both sides, you know.
Right, right, exactly. So this is one of the concerns that United States government has had all along, and why it's kept a very close eye on this, right, apart from the NATO angle.
Right.
And losing Greece from NATO.
Wow.
Yeah. Hmm. The European Union's top prosecutor said today she has been told that smugglers' boats bringing migrants across the Mediterranean, as you know, there's many thousands of them, to Europe, are also carrying ISIS fighters.
Yikes.
Michel Konings, head of the EU's Judicial Cooperation Agency Eurojust, told reporters she received the information as part of the organization's efforts to help EU nations jointly respond to illegal immigration, terrorism, and cybercrime. So she also said groups like ISIS are using proceeds from people trafficking to fund terrorism.
Yeah.
So they're very concerned about this. Separately, President Obama is making a rare visit to the Pentagon this afternoon to get an update from military leaders on the campaign against ISIS.
Very interesting.
Environmental and safety groups are planning a week of protests against transporting crude oil by train, marking the second anniversary of a major oil train disaster in Canada, the Lac Mégantique. They're asking regulators to crack down further on crude by rail and pushing local governments to ban such trains within their jurisdiction.
Yeah. Okay.
The latest on the Iran nuclear deal negotiations, there seems to be a bit of a sticking point. The broader arms embargo and dispute over UN sanctions on Iran's ballistic missile program among issues holding up a nuclear deal between Tehran and six world powers today, just one day before their latest self-imposed deadline. And so we'll see whether they make it to the deadline, whether they have to punt another couple of days or whether the whole thing falls apart. It's really very unclear. Secretary John Kerry of State John Kerry did say yesterday there are hard choices and that it could go either way.
Yeah. And hopefully they can work this thing out. I mean, that would be a very consequential piece of President Obama's legacy.
It would be. It would be. A deleted retweet by Donald Trump seems to be getting into some trouble. It was a retweet that was live on Twitter for a full day before it was deleted, according to Hollywood news site The Wrap. At Ron Heilbronn, at Real Donald Trump, hashtag Jeb Bush has to like the Mexican illegals because of his wife.
Yikes. His wife is Mexican American. I mean, she literally was born in Mexico.
Right.
But he met her in Mexico, didn't he?
Yes, I believe he did. Yeah. Yes. That was up there for a day.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And Donald Trump was retweeting it.
Donald Trump retweeted this. Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. Hillary Clinton's campaign is worried about Bernie Sanders, according to Clinton Communications Director Jennifer Palmieri today. We are worried about him, sure. He will be a serious force for the campaign, and I don't think that will diminish.
Yeah. They're figuring it out. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Have a great afternoon.
You too.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And on the line with us is Professor Harvey Kay, Professor of Democracy and Social and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin, Green Bay, author of numerous books. His latest, The Fight for the Four Freedoms, What Made FDR and the Greatest Generation Truly Great. And his book about Thomas Paine and the Promise of America is one of my favorites. Harvey, welcome back.
Thank you. I love being on your show.
Thank you. Claire McCaskill has said that on television, I think it was a couple of days ago, wasn't it?
Late last week.
Yeah, that Bernie Sanders, nothing to worry about. There's no droids in this car. I mean, actually, I'm guessing that you know or have, since you wrote an op-ed about it, her exact words. You want to share them with us?
Well, first you said that Bernie was too liberal.
Right.
Okay. Then she had the audacity to compare him, I believe it was, to Pat Buchanan and Ron Paul in the Republican Party in the past, which, I mean, to compare Bernie to racists like that is beyond me, but it's a shame that I thought all along that while the Republicans were losing their minds, that at least the Democrats had been holding on to theirs, and clearly there's something awry there. Well, and then most importantly, she said his message was too extreme, and that's really what kicked it off. Extreme implied that they were really losing their memories, that the Democratic Party had completely forgotten its roots as far back as Thomas Paine, my hero, all the way through to Franklin Roosevelt, my favorite president, that there was this social democratic strain. And she said democratic socialism, social democracy was too extreme. And she was obviously forgetting American history.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us about American history?
You've got Thomas Paine, who's to my mind, the godfather of America, really. He's the man who first calls for independence and the creation of a democratic republic. And in the course of years that followed, when he had gone and contributed to the French Revolution and to the making of the British labor movement, he wrote Rights of Man and then Agrarian Justice, in which he says, if we can get rid of the royalists, and then he says, in any case, we ought to be creating a fund, a national fund, out of which we can create old age pensions and we can create stakes, STAKES, for young people. This is the way to fight poverty, empower people, basically.
Right.
And then that idea continues through American life. And throughout the 19th century, you've got generation upon generation of immigrants. You've got, you know, the German American sewer socialists out here in the Midwest who truly built the Midwestern cities and did so in the name of democratic socialism and social democracy. You've got the farmers and laborers who flocked to the grand encampments on the plains, organized by socialists and populists. You've got Jewish and Italian textile, well, sweatshop workers late in the 19th century into the 20th century, organized again by socialists. And all of that energy goes in, of course, to making the progressive movement and even more significantly, FDR's New Deal, which is the great social democratic moment in America. In fact, and if I sound agitated, it's because I am. I can't believe what I'm hearing out there. It's astounding to consider how much we celebrate FDR and the Greatest Generation with monuments on the National Mall. They're not that far down the road from where McCaskill spends most of her time in the Capitol. And what does she do? She completely ignores the fact that FDR and the Greatest Generation were social democratic folk.
Right.
On top of which, we've got the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial. And Martin Luther King was himself a democratic socialist. So it's very upsetting. It's really upsetting when Democrats forget their own history and really what makes America great.
I have heard Republicans say that Martin Luther King was a Republican, and I've never had any evidence presented to me of that, but I've literally had several Republicans. It apparently is a big Republican talking point. One of his daughters is a regular contributor to Fox so-called News, and that may have something to do with it. I don't know.
But, well, these are the same Republicans who tell us America is essentially a conservative nation because if they repeat it enough, they believe it might actually happen. Right. The fact is that Martin Luther King grew up in a household, and the senior Martin Luther King down in Atlanta was a New Dealer. I mean, he supported the New Deal, and Martin Luther King Jr. grew up in just that kind of environment, and he brought together the New Deal experience and Christian socialism to create a nonviolent, peaceful, democratic socialist perspective on America. There's plenty of evidence there. I've had some tweets from people saying, can I prove what I'm saying? I mean, it's in all the decent biographies. Everyone knows he was a social democrat. He fought not only for civil rights, he fought for labor rights and the rights of working poor and the poor.
Yeah, of all races.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to me that Claire McCaskill is simply trying to take down Bernie because she's a surrogate for the Clinton campaign. It's the only explanation that immediately comes to mind.
Yeah, I think you're right. But the irony there is that Hillary Clinton herself launched her campaign. I think you'll recall, I spoke to your people around that time on at FDR Four Freedoms Park in New York on Roosevelt Island, which is a monument. What to what?
To social democratic democracy. Socialism.
I mean, it's truly astounding as I said, it's one thing for Republicans to lose their minds. It's another thing when Democrats start losing their memories. That's very, very upsetting.
Yeah. Well, I think the way that Hillary Clinton could easily win the primary and easily win the general election is to simply steal Bernie Sanders' platform.
Absolutely. But, it's interesting. I mean, I was thrilled that Hillary decided to go to Roosevelt Island because, in fact, it called attention to the Four Freedoms. But I did notice that the one thing she did not do when she was there is she did not actually tell Americans what the Four Freedoms were. In her speech, there was no specific reference to what the Four Freedoms were. It kind of reminded me of when Bill Clinton spoke of Thomas Jefferson and literally left out the fact that Jefferson called for a little rebellion every 20 years or so.
Yeah. Yeah. Among other things.
Among other things, yes, absolutely.
So what – how do we –
Oh, by the way, if I could just note, Kathleen Barker had a piece over the weekend in which she makes the case that Americans should shiver at the thought of Sanders' campaign and possible, nomination.
Yeah,
and
I'm
thinking, is she wants to shiver from thrills or is she just absolutely afraid of a truly democratic America?
Well, I think, and it may be that Kathleen Parker is also, representative of the Hillary campaign. I think what is more likely, though, is that what we're seeing going on right now in both the Democratic and Republican parties is the insiders versus the outsiders.
Yeah, and, well said, Tom. Very well said.
Yeah, and the insiders, the existing power structure, Hillary Clinton, Claire McCaskill, they're all part of the existing power structure. They're definite insiders. Bernie's definitely an outsider. It must
kill them that you broadcast from Washington D.C.
Yeah, instead of Vermont. Well, we started in Vermont.
Instead of Vermont, right.
We started in Vermont. The show. That's how I met Bernie. Bernie.
Oh, fabulous.
Bernie,
that's great.
We started the show in my living room, and Bernie would come over and sit in the living room with me, and we'd be on the air.
I love that. I remember reading about Bernie back in these times, the newspaper back in the 1970s, a newspaper is still now a magazine. And I thought, now there's the kind of candidate I'd love to see run for president. Here we are, you know, these many years later, it's happening.
Here's what he said. Here's what Bernie said in 1991, the day after George Herbert Walker Bush invaded Kuwait and Iraq. He said, we should make no mistake about it. Today is a tragic day. This is Bernie. On the floor of the House. Today is a tragic day for humanity, for the people of Iraq, for the people of the United States, and the UN as an institution. It's also a tragic day for the future of our planet and for the children, 30,000 of whom in the third world will starve to death today as we spend billions to wage this war, and 25% of whom in our own country live in poverty because we apparently lack the funds to provide them with a minimal standard of living. And then he goes on to say, despite the fact that we are now aligned with such Middle Eastern dictatorships such as Syria, a terrorist dictatorship, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, feudalistic dictatorships, and Egypt, a one-party state that gets $7 billion in debt forgiveness to wage this war with us, I believe that in the long run, the action unleashed last night will go strongly against our interests in the Middle East. Clearly, the United States and allies will win this war, but the death and destruction caused will, in my opinion, not be forgotten by the poor people of the Third World, and the people of the Middle East in particular. I fear that one day we will regret that decision and that we are, in fact, laying the groundwork for more and more wars for years to come. Amazing. Harvey K., Professor Harvey K. Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you. At Harvey J.K.
There you go. At Harvey
this
J.K.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
That's at Harvey J.K.A.Y.E. Just FYI. We'll be back. Welcome back, 20 minutes past the hour. Remarkable, the state of politics these days and, you know, everything that's going on. A couple of other things that I came across today that I wanted to quickly share with you. A Coke-backed, you know, we've got a real problem with Cokeheads in this country. Claire Mosier is writing at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress. Just in time for the 4th of July, when millions of people across the country will visit America's national parks and other public lands, the Koch brothers are rolling out their latest campaign against these treasured places, pushing for no more national parks. In an op-ed published in Tuesday's New York Times, Reed Watson, the executive director of the Koch-backed Property and Environmental Research Center, PERC, PERC, along with the research associate at the center, called for no more national parks, citing the backlog of maintenance for existing parks. She says, PERC has a long history of advocating the privatization of America's national parks and other public land and has significant ties both to the Koch brothers and the fossil fuel industries. Yeah, okay, just so you know, right, a couple things. Here's this is bizarre. This white guy admits to plotting to massacre Muslims. They wiretapped him. And the wiretap, he says, we're going to be carrying an M4 with 500 rounds of ammunition, light armor piercing, a pistol with three extra magazines and a machete. And if it gets down to the machete, we will cut them to shreds. He's trying to, as part of a plea agreement, he pled guilty to interstate communication of threats, facing 5 years in jail. But a federal judge, Curtis Collier, may not accept the guilty plea. He's ordered the prosecution and defense to produce briefs proving that Doggart was a true threat. Meanwhile, a different federal judge, Magistrate Susan K. Lee, released Doggart from jail into the custody of two family members. Can you imagine if this guy had been a Muslim and had been talking about killing Americans? Or if this had been, I don't know if the Symbionese Liberation Army was that far out, but if this had been some, you know, radical black group of some kind talking about killing white people, there's no way that they would set him free. What privilege on parade. Police union in Philadelphia. The chief of police, Charles Ramsey, is trying to increase transparency in his police department. And so he has released the names of officers who have shot people. In fact, he released the names of two officers involved in a May shooting incident last Friday. And the officers, Michael Miner and Robert Hopp, shot and wounded a man after he allegedly hit an officer's car and fled the scene. Ramsey took similar action in December when he announced the name of an officer who shot a 25-year-old man during a traffic stop. So what happens? Lodge 5 of the Fraternal Order of Police, the union organization representing the employees of the Philadelphia Police Department, just filed an unfair labor complaint against him. We don't want people to know what cops are killing or shooting people.
Right.
The text of there's been a leak of the TPP. There's been a bunch of these, and now there's this new leak. This is about the TSA, TISA, they call it, Trade-In Services Agreement. I guess TSA would have been confusing. And Laurie Sanders and the folks at Public Citizen, citizen.org, sent this thing out. And basically, they're saying that if this agreement goes through, here's what they said. It would be helpful if policymakers acted with some recognition that the 2008-2009 financial crisis actually occurred. It shouldn't be hard. In the United States alone, nearly $20 trillion in wealth was lost. You know, the net of this is what they're saying is that this trade and services agreement is going to further deregulate the banks. Brilliant. Right? Just what we need. Anyhow, I got a bunch of other stuff in my stack here we will get to as the day goes on, but I know a lot of you are on the phone and you want to have something to say. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I wanted to add to what was it in your news there at the top of the hour about Michigan and the legislation that prevents local municipalities and so on from raising wages.
Right.
That bill also includes prevents local governments from providing more job training.
Brilliant.
I learned that when I was back there. I just got back, as you know, last week.
Yeah.
And of course, their tax levy to raise the sales tax to fix the roads failed in May, so now they're taking it. They're basically going through the couch looking for change.
Yeah.
To do the roads, and I saw on a local show one of the Republican brand new representative wanted to. They have a catastrophic fund for if you're injured in an auto accident. They have no fault insurance. It has a $20 million in the fund. He thought, well, we should take that, take half of that. And I thought, how far is $10 million going to get you down to the end of the street?
Right.
So
right.
This is what their plan is. But my topic is sort of follow up on that is look at how the Republicans are doubling down. I thought of three major things that they've just lost. Three strikes, you're out.
Yeah, what are those three things? Marriage. Quickly, Paul.
Yeah, same-sex marriage, Obamacare, and
Confederate flag.
Yeah,
it's amazing. It's amazing. They are doubling down, and it is making them look stupid. Paul, thank you for the call. It's always great to hear from you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with more Anything Goes Summer right after this. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. The place for despair is not an option. Speaking the truth to multinational corporations, which really rather you didn't know all about. Louise in Tulare, California. Am I saying that right, Louise?
Yes, Louise in Tulare. Yeah, that's like
Louise.
Part of the agricultural center in
uh-huh.
California.
Okay.
So first of all, when you were talking about the Koch brothers wanting to, was it privatize the national parks or
yeah.
get rid of them, or what was the story?
Either one. There's a lot of minerals on those national parks, and they would love to buy them up and drill, or mine.
Yeah, I was just at Yosemite National Park a couple of weeks ago, and you know, just laying there staring up at the waterfalls, and I was just thinking, you know, it's a good thing the private sector hasn't got in here, but now you read that piece of news, and I'm just like, whoa, I cannot believe that they want to go that far.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
The reason I was calling was because last week when you were talking about Bernie Sanders a lot, showing the clips, there was a lot of people calling in that wanted to know, you know, how can we help out? People that were very excited about Bernie Sanders' campaign and wants to do something to help him out because, you know, he's running off of small donations and, you know, the grassroots movement that he's building. And I think that one way we can all help out, you know, just from where we are, is to really get out the word about the debates. Because, in 08, when Hillary was going up against Obama, they debated over 20 times. They were debating. The first debate was in April 2007. So both of them got a lot of press coverage, and they got a lot of interviews, and time on, cable news and major networks. This time they're only debating six times, Bernie Sanders and Hillary. They're only debating six times, but they think it's really bad for Bernie because he won't get as much coverage.
Hillary is as insider an insider as you can get in the Democratic Party, and the party is in some ways kind of closing ranks behind her, I think. And that said, I really don't want to turn this show into the Bernie's better than Hillary show. I think either one of them would make a great president. I keep hoping that Hillary Clinton will steal Bernie's agenda.
Yeah, well, it's not like you're saying that. It's your caller saying that, so you kind of like let it go. But I was just kind of a response to the people that were calling last week, and I would just say, anybody that that has a little bit of interest in politics and, are willing to hear different sides, really have to watch the debates.
Yeah.
I want to debate six times.
Yeah, I'm with you, Luis. I think I can fairly easily predict what Bernie's going to say. He's said all these things enough times on this show over the last 10 years. I want to hear what Hillary's going to have to say. I'm looking forward to that.
And I think there's a lot of people that are, just naturally leaning toward Hillary just because they know her better. Like, for example, my sister's one of them. She's excited about Hillary. But there's a lot of people that are leaning toward Hillary, but really they haven't even listened to Bernie's message because who covers his message on TV?
Right. Yeah.
Nobody really.
Yeah, exactly. And when they do, they don't talk about the issues that he's talking about. They talk about his hair or his personality or, the horse race, Yeah. So I'm with you, Luis.
I'm telling everybody, encourage, get the word out. And the bad thing is that the Democratic Party hasn't even announced when the first debate's going to be, which also I think kind of hurts them because we can't tell people, August, like the Republicans, they're starting August 6th.
Yeah.
But Democrats, if you look online, it only tells you fall, August or September. We don't even really know when.
Right.
So I'm just waiting for that date to come up so I can just, start getting the word out. We have to listen. We're only asking for, 6 days of your time, just six debates. That's all we're going to get.
Yeah.
And I feel that there's a lot of people that once they hear Bernie's message, you just can't argue with it.
I don't think so. I think you're right, Luis. Luis, I got to move along here and pick up some other callers. But, Luis, thank you very much for the call, and great to hear from you. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. I was wondering if people refuse to pay their student loans, if that would bring the banks and the congressmen to the table to hear their demand.
It would. And it could also burst a multi-trillion dollar derivative bubble, which has grown based on student loans. And people are pouring, literally trillions of dollars, perhaps hundreds of trillions of dollars, into these derivatives on the assumption that these student loans are, unlike the old subprime mortgages, that these student loans are as good as gold, because the bankruptcy law was rewritten back in 2006 during the Bush administration to make it impossible for students to use bankruptcy. I saw Donald Trump on television yesterday, and the person said, you've declared bankruptcy a bunch of times. And Trump is like, yeah, I'm a smart guy. I use the bankruptcy laws to my advantage. I see a company that's in trouble, I'll buy it, I'll bankrupt it, and then I restart it. And I'm thinking, but Congress passed a law making it illegal for students to do that with their student debt.
I'm ashamed. I'm really ashamed some of the senators have gone behind it, like Feinstein and, of course, Boehner did it, but
this was largely a Republican-led effort, although there were a number of Democrats on board with it. Joe Biden, was promoting it, and it's unfortunate. So, yeah, I think, Jeff, if there is a movement to repudiate student loan debt, and it's starting right now with Corinthian College, it's for-profit fraud, and we'll see where that goes. But if that movement escapes out of Corinthian College and goes national and goes wide, and people all over the country just start saying, I'm not going to pay my student loan. I don't care if my credit score goes to 100. This is nuts. Then I think something very consequential could happen.
Yeah, I was thinking that would even be part of the bargaining chip is, you know, if you refuse, that it doesn't affect your credit rating.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, we want a Jubilee is my take on it. You know, it's, I mean, literally a Jubilee, it's from the Bible. It's, you know, every 7 years, every 7 years the fields were fallow. Every seven times 7 years, every 50 years, on the, every 50th year, all the slaves were freed, all the money from the entire community, you know, all the wealth went into one pot and then got evenly redistributed among all the people, and all debts were erased. And and that's that. You know, I, with regard to student loan debt, I think it's time for us to be doing that. Jeff, thank you for the call. Great, great point. Jim in Raton, New Mexico, R-A-T-O-N. Am I saying it right?
Yeah, it's pronounced Raton.
Raton. Okay, that sounds much more elegant. So, what's up?
Well, since you have a few connections in Hollywood and New York City, would you please consider floating a couple ideas to your connections? The country needs a good documentary series about labor history in the United States, and naturally Ken Burns would be great for that. And we all, to go along with that, we also need a good biography movie about Mother Jones.
Yeah.
And
Jim, I would encourage you to send a message to Ken Burns. I don't know Ken Burns, and I would encourage you to send a note to him. I can't be your surrogate, but if this is something you're really passionate about, go for it. Jerry in Yucca, Arizona. Hey, Jerry, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
It's still before noon here. I had a couple of comments on illegal immigration and then a question, if I might.
Okay.
First thing... you know, we have some illegal immigrants and whatnot that come into our country, and they can get away with using your Social Security number, your credit, and all kinds of stuff. And
it's not, you know, actually, Jerry, you're wrong. There are very few people who are in this country without documentation who are using stolen Social Security numbers. Most of the people using stolen social they're using, you know, made up social security numbers, non-existent social security numbers, but they're not stealing them. That's a crime, and these folks are afraid of getting arrested. The people who are using your social security numbers that are stolen are organized criminals, and many of them are based overseas. So you know, it's this, that has nothing to do with the problem of people who are here undocumented.
Okay.
In fact, they're paying into the Social Security Trust Fund. They're paying into our taxes. You know, billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars a year.
Yeah, well, that's probably true.
No, it is true.
The question that I had, and this is probably going to sound really stupid, but I realize that we have naturalized citizens that are born here. If we have illegal immigrants that are here illegally, when they're having as many children as they can, as fast as they can, isn't that an illegal act?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I mean
this is the 14th Amendment. I mean, I had this discussion with Pat Buchanan back a year ago, and you know, he's railing about quote illegal immigration into the United States, and I'm offended by the term. I don't think that anybody is illegal. People do illegal things, but that doesn't, you know, they're still human beings. And
no,
to call them illegals is to dehumanize them. But anyhow, he was concerned about the 14th Amendment, which says that if you are born on American soil, you are automatically a citizen. And I said, okay, I have a concern about the 14th Amendment too, in that according to the U.S. Supreme Court, the 14th Amendment gives equal protection rights to corporations because they're people. So I'm fine with giving up birth citizenship if you're fine with giving up corporations being people. And I don't remember how Pat Buchanan responded to that, but yeah, it's not something that we're gonna see negotiated anytime soon.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But the question of how do you determine citizenship is an interesting one. I mean, here it's were you born here, and most other countries it's not. Minutes before the hour, welcome back. Keith in Pahoa, Hawaii, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Keith, what's up? Keith, I can't hear you again. I don't get it. Maybe Keith has his phone muted. Chris in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Chris, thanks for listening to Sirius. What's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to thank you for all the years of entertainment. Long-time listener. I think you're brilliant.
Thank you.
I wanted to just touch base. I know you were talking about Hillary and Bernie, and I want to kind of piggyback on a caller previously. And one of the things that concerns me with Hillary is that, you know, when you said, yeah, I'm waiting to see what she has to say. And as a progressive, that makes me more reassured or kind of reaffirms with me that she is an insider who's going to be really hesitant about where she's going to stand. And, you know, whereas with Bernie, we always know where he stands, you know? And I wanted to get your take on that, if you feel the same way as a person.
Well, I don't disagree with the assessment, Chris, but I would remind you that Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, was, you know, the relatively corrupt governor of one of the most corrupt states in the United States, New York. And his attorney general was responsible for policing Wall Street and did nothing to prevent the crash of 1929. And he was an insider. He was wealthy, and he campaigned on a platform of, well, let's not do much, and, you know, slow and steady, and, you know, don't rock the boat, and things will get better. And but when he became president, the week that he became president, all the banks in the United States closed. They all failed, just like Greece right now. Actually, worse than Greece. And that provoked him. I mean, the public outcry was so great that FDR became FDR. And I think that I really believe that Hillary Clinton has the potential to come out in that way also if the times are right. I don't believe in the great man theory of history. I don't think that it's a matter of getting just the right person in the office. I think it's and Bernie talks about this, too. He says, you know, he's trying to start a political movement. Well, if that movement is large enough and broad enough and strong enough, then it doesn't matter who's in the White House or who's in the Senate or in the House. That movement will push them. And you know, they will become what we need. At least that's the great lesson of history in my mind. I mean, Abraham Lincoln, numerous times, go back to the Lincoln-Douglas debate, said he was not in favor of integrating white and black people. And yet, you know, the occasion came and he rose to it. I think this is the story of history. Thomas Jefferson, just 3 years before he wrote the Declaration of Independence, wrote a pamphlet. It's about a 30-page booklet titled A Summary View of the Rights of British Americans that was basically a how-to guide on how to be a good citizen of the United Kingdom while living in North America. He was, you know, totally opposed to independence. The Boston Tea Party happened that fall. He wrote it in the summer. The Boston Tea Party happens that fall, and boom, it's off to the races, right? I mean, you know, it's like the times changed, and the leaders became the leaders. And so I realize, you know, some
of that potential.
Yeah, I realize some people think I'm being optimistic or rose-colored glasses or something, but I have read history. And, you know, this is...
I can tell.
This is what history tells me.
And
yeah. So, yeah, and my dad was a history junkie. He wanted to be a history professor, but my mom getting pregnant with me put an end to that. He had to drop out of college. And but I, you know, I've been learning history since I was a little kid. Anyhow, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. I we'll see where this
really
all goes.
I really appreciate all you do. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Jim in Washington, Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hi. I think you pretty well answered my question. I was worried about Bernie being perceived as a George McGovern because, you know, I worked on that campaign and, you know, we got our butts handed to us.
Yeah. Well, here's the problem. George McGovern was principally campaigning on I'm going to end the Vietnam War. And, you know, he was he was the anti-war candidate. And there was a strong anti-war sentiment in the United States, but it was mostly held by people who were not who were of draft age. And I think being against the war, I mean, Bernie opposed the 1991 invasion of Iraq. I mean, he's been pretty much opposed to most of the wars that we've been involved with. But he's not campaigning on that. He's campaigning on the economy. The economy was strong when McGovern was campaigning. That this was before Reagan. This, you know, the Reagan had not taken down the middle class yet. Now we've got 35 years of Reaganism. It's destroyed our middle class. And Bernie is running on an economic populist platform. I think that gives him incredible mojo, and I think that it's just a canard. This came from Claire McCaskill, right? As a surrogate for the Hillary campaign, that Bernie would be like George McGovern. No way. Different campaign, different people, different times. No way. So,
McGovern's strength came from the energy of the youth that were supposed to be backing him.
Yeah.
And it just didn't happen.
Well, no, a lot of young people turned out, but I don't remember when. I think this was before the 28th Amendment was passed, or 27th Amendment, the one that lowered the voting age to 18. I'd have to go back and look at what happened when, but it may be that at that point in time, young people could not vote. 18 to 21, you know, that the voting age was 21. And if that was the case, that might account for some of it. But basically, you know, McGovern was campaigning. I mean, there was some economic populism to his message, but America was a strong, robust, healthy nation at that time. You know, America was.
The unions weren't really backing McGovern.
Yeah, well, that's because there was a big battle going on within the unions about whether or not to support or oppose the Vietnam War. So, because there was a lot of, you know, I mean, a lot of manufacturing, there was a lot of money being made, but there were a lot of jobs being created by that war, too. So, anyhow, that was 72. I'm pretty sure that it was a couple of years later that the voting age was lowered. 71. Oh, it was 71. Okay, so young people could vote. Interesting. Jim, thanks for the call. And thank you all for listening, watching, calling, participating today in our program. And we'll be back tomorrow. Same time, same place. Don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you to participate. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.